Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. These Soapbox podcasts are wholly sponsored, which means everyone you hear in a Soapbox podcast here at Risky.biz paid to be here. And normally, you know, you hear from security vendors in these Soapbox shows and they want to sell you their stuff. But today, it's something a little bit different. This edition of the show is brought to you by Facebook. And yeah, I know, they're a controversial company right now. Some of you won't want sponsored content from Facebook in your podcast feeds, and you know, that's your call. Fair enough. I'm not telling you have to like it. And in fact, I'm half expecting to catch a bit of shit for taking these guys on as a sponsor. I mean, I know they are facing an advertiser backlash right now over hate speech issues and content moderation. And I also feel like some of that criticism is warranted. But I just want to clear something up. Facebook ain't Cloudflare, okay? They do actually have a content policy, but enforcing speech norms across over 2 billion accounts is pretty fucking hard, okay? If you have a solution to that, let me know. I'll help you write the patent application, and we're all going to make billions of dollars, right? So, yeah, look, if you really feel like you want to fight me over Facebook being here, then by all means, hit me up. Risky Business, one word. That's my Twitter handle. Come fight me there, and that'll be a good time. But anyway, on to the actual podcast now. And yeah, why is Facebook's security engineering group sponsoring a Soapbox edition of the Risky Business podcast? Well, it's not to talk about content moderation. They want to talk about what they do in the security engineering group. And one of the reasons they want to do that is because they're always hiring, right? So to do a podcast with us, to talk about all of the cool stuff they get to do in security engineering at Facebook, you know, it's a nice way for them to essentially describe the environment, describe the work in the hopes that, hey, some of you listening out there might want to go and apply for some jobs. Now, in some ways, in my mind at least, Facebook is similar in some ways to like Google and Amazon, in the sense that they basically all had to develop their own scalable infrastructure before cloud compute was a thing. I mean, at this point, I'm actually half surprised that Facebook Web Services isn't a thing, right? Amazon started as a bookstore before AWS came out, right? And that's where they make their money. So yeah, I mean, a lot of these key big internet brands, they actually had to spin up their own scalable infrastructure before it was a thing. So that's sort of where we're going to start with this podcast. Joining me today to talk through a whole bunch of stuff, we've got Pedro Kanawati, who is the VP of Engineering, Privacy and Security, and Chris Bream, who is the Security Engineering Director. And yeah, like what I was alluding to there is I really wanted to start at the beginning. Pedro's been with Facebook for quite a while, right? So he's seen a lot of change. And yeah, I wanted to talk about how they built that scalable infrastructure, how they built their own language for their application called Hack, how they built their own static analysis tools for that language. You know, that one's called, you'll hear it referred to, Zonkalon. And, you know, they basically roll their own everything, right? So this interview, it's not really directly relevant to the average enterprise environment, you know, the average enterprise security team, but there are lessons for all of us when we talk to people at companies like this who regard security as critical to their survival, and their security teams have access to bottomless checkbooks, right? So you wind up with some pretty interesting stuff to talk about. And that's what this is. So I'm going to drop you in here as Pedro Kanawati talks about some of the changes he's seen in his decade at Facebook. I hope you enjoy this. Cheers.
When I got here at Facebook, it was just a pure LAMP stack. We had all just our Linux, our Apache, MySQL, and PHP. And we had to, over time, just significantly increase the footprint that we had. When I joined, it was tens of thousands of servers, so I had already like missed the beginning of it, but now it's into millions. We had only one data center. It's now more than dozens, and it's global. And so we had to migrate a lot of the infrastructure that we had and a lot of the work that we were doing to be scalable with fewer people. And so we didn't want to hire armies of engineers that were going to be managing the physical infrastructure. So we had to move in the same way that a virtual infrastructure did, or a sort of an AWS or a GCP. And so we built all that infrastructure internally for us to be able to manage things at scale easily.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't just go out and rent your GCP or Azure or AWS back then, right? You had to build it yourself.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's funny too, when you just, I mean, there were some trigger words there too for me, like PHP, MySQL, Apache, like, because that was basically everything back then, right? And it worked. It worked until you had to scale it up to like hundreds of millions and billions of users, right? which is why you had to do it. So walk us through that.
Yeah, so there were a couple of sort of key decisions that we had to make. One is PHP was the language of choice that we had decided to use as a company. It was actually pretty easy to hire people to code in PHP. It's very C++-like, and so there's a lot of like people that can easily come in and learn the language really quickly. The problem is PHP doesn't scale as well as most other languages like C++ or Java. But we didn't want to lose the flexibility of using PHP. So we had to build our just-in-time compiler locally. And so we had to translate PHP into machine code. And so we had to make some decisions early on about how we were going to do that. And that would give us the efficiencies of development for PHP, but actually give us the efficiencies of scale of C++. So that was something that we worked on early on. And then eventually one of the biggest problems that we had was the complexity of the systems that people were building. So I helped build an organization called Production Engineering, whose job was primarily to simplify the operations of our systems at scale. So we built a lot of scaffolding that allowed us to deploy to a bunch of systems really quickly, to be able to understand the monitoring that we had, and to be able to scale that out so that we could quickly see what was happening across the infrastructure without having to spend a lot of time doing the analysis. But the systems would do the analysis for us. Couple other sort of decisions that we made was trying to figure out how we would do, instead of a disaster recovery site, we would always have an active location. And most companies, what they do is they try to do an active or passive, an active and passive system. And for us, we really just realized that we were going to continue to be growing. The users were coming.
You're never going to have that much spare capacity, right? Like,
exactly,
it's just not going to happen. Yeah, it's funny. Well, I feel like that's. You know, that thinking has changed, right? Like, it used to be you'd have your failover sites, and in a flexible DevOps-y sort of world, that's just not the case. Chris Bream is also with us. Chris, you had something to share there?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think for me, I came in much later than Pedro. So I got to see sort of where this stuff had already, a lot of these sort of early approaches had evolved. And so, you know, Pedro mentioned PHP, and one of the things that was sort of an outcome of the challenge of scaling PHP that Pedro had mentioned was we created a language called Hack, which is built on top of PHP and allowed us to create that just-in-time compiler and scale with what we're doing today. But as part of that language creation, we also added some things that were really helpful from a security perspective. So we added typing. So, you know, Hack is typed and we can type things. And that is huge wins from a secure perspective.
Because, yeah, I mean, I can imagine there would have been a few listeners going, oh, okay, you built something that turns PHP into C++. That sounds totally safe, right? Like, that's the sort of thing that, you know, you're just picturing Monk's scream painting at that point, right? Like, that sounds like double fail. But I guess if you're the ones building the infrastructure and you know, something that takes one thing, turns it into another, you've got a bit of control there, right?
Yeah, like it gives us a bunch of control. I mean, obviously we're super beneficial that we can even do something like this. I think a lot of companies aren't going to have that benefit, and I totally understand that. But that control allows us to do a whole number of different things, right? Like I said, typing in Hack is a huge win because untyped languages create all types of issues that lead to developers making mistakes that lead to security vulnerabilities. We could then build things like our static analysis tool Zonkalon. So Zonkalon is built for Hack. And it allows us to do at-scale static analysis that makes it easier for us to automate the detection of bugs. And, you know, we're shipping like tens of thousands of diffs a week, and we can run across all of those with Zonkalon, and it really helps us scale up the security expertise because we can, you know, help teams solve their own problems and identify their own issues, and then take some security engineering experts who are extremely good but also extremely hard to find and extremely expensive, and have them tackle these like bigger, gnarlier problems that we can't create systems or machines to automate away.
Okay, so you've talked about how you developed, you know, essentially a way to develop and deploy the application. And I'm guessing that was friendly to scalable infrastructure, but then, you know, we haven't spoken about the infrastructure piece at all. I want to come back to the code scanning and stuff, but okay, so you've got this new, you know, PHP to C++ translator. What do you then run it on?
We ran it on custom hardware that we built out for Open Compute, which we actually open source to the world, and they can actually put together machines like they want to themselves. but it's basically Linux. That's the core OS of it. We do have a kernel team that spends a lot of time doing analysis on the speed and efficiency of the kernel and making it better over time. And then on top of that, we have so Facebook is built more like a service-oriented architecture system. So there's a lot of RPC calls from the web server, which is hack specific. And then it calls back into backend systems, and each of those are written in C++ or in Java or things like that. Effectively, we do have a lot of MySQL still. We store most of our data directly into MySQL, and then we have a lot of specialized data stores for things like, you know, photo blobs or videos, or a lot of the query interfaces that we have for the graph. Those have separate storages that we built internally.
Yeah, so I mean, I just even try to wrap my head around what your database infrastructure would look like. I mean, that would just basically be a gigantic cluster of MySQL, right?
We have multiple gigantic clusters of MySQL.
It's funny, right? Because people used to kind of like poo-poo MySQL, and I think this is proof that it actually can work quite well, right?
Yeah, it does have its own scaling challenges. Most companies don't get to the size that we do, and so they don't hit those scaling challenges. But we spent, again, a lot of time with the industry and the community on building the ways that we can scale it out. And so we created new storage systems for MySQL itself. We open sourced those. We worked with MariaDB and the MySQL community to be able to get those out to everybody so that they could benefit from the same level of knowledge that we had about storage.
So this is interesting. I mean, we are like 10 minutes into this, and already we've spoken about 10 years of sort of infrastructure development, you know, the creation of a custom way of porting PHP to C++ to make it fast, to make it scalable. You're talking about customized Linux kernels operating gigantic clusters of MySQL, right? So, I mean, from an infrastructure perspective, Facebook, by the looks of things, I mean, it's a mishmash of your own stuff plus customized open source and at massive scale. I mean, that's essentially, if we're to describe Facebook, the infrastructure that operates the core application, that's it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously from there, then you've got the application, right? So I'd imagine that security engineering and ops, right? Like you spend a lot of time around that infrastructure. What about the application? Is that also the same people who work on the infrastructure? Is it the same groups who work on the infrastructure who wind up focused on the application as well? Like, I'm just trying to get a sense, right? And I thought that would be an interesting way to do this podcast. I'm just trying to get a sense for even trying to define what Facebook is from a computing perspective, and then look at how you begin to manage that.
Yeah, this is actually where we do get some benefits about the way that we've built Facebook. The applications are where the business logic happens. And so that's typically where our product security team spends a lot of its time. And they do spend time on our backend, but our backend system is doing a lot of the manipulation of the data and then presenting it back to the rendering layer. And so we've separated those two out. And so our product security team can focus a lot on the data that is being presented to the user and making sure that that data is secure.
Yeah, and I mean, Patrick, you compared early on, you kind of compared to, you know, or you mentioned kind of Amazon and AWS, and you mentioned Google and GCP, and of course, Microsoft and Azure, and how, you know, they have this infrastructure that they provide to their customers to then build whatever things they need on top of it. And the way that we operate is not actually that different. It's we build this infrastructure. It's just that it's private, and we have private customers, so to speak. And we have a small number of very large customers like Facebook, like Instagram, like WhatsApp, like, you know, Oculus, where there's this infrastructure that's built, the product teams can then use to build their products on top of and deliver all of these services to people all around the world. And so, you know, when we think about it, we think about how can we build that infrastructure in a way that, you know, gives capabilities to teams that are building products, but also, you know, makes it easier for them to avoid making mistakes that could result in like some kind of security issue. Whether that's, hey, we've got this infrastructure that's secure, you just build on top of it, right? Or here's a framework that you can use for developing your product that makes it safe by default. Like all of those are the ways that we get economies of scale and help ensure that, you know, we create these sort of secure applications on top of this massive infrastructure.
I remember speaking to Brad Arkin, who's now the CISO of Cisco, and at the time was at Adobe, and they did so many acquisitions back then you know, there was one happening every 2 weeks or something, and then he'd be the guy who'd have to, you know, go in and have a look at the absolute horror show that he was going to be responsible for. And in the end, I think he wound up coming up with the manual, right? Which is like, there's 5 ways you can do things, pick one. And I'm wondering, like, how tightly have you been able to integrate some of these other services like WhatsApp, Instagram? Are they running on that same infrastructure, or is it all a little bit different depending on the use case?
It mostly runs on the same infrastructure. There are some caveats there into certain things. Like, for example, Instagram and the acquisition, they run a Python stack as opposed to a PHP stack. And so we built purpose use infrastructure for Python to do the same things, but then we actually integrate them into the same set of systems that we do. So they get the same level of monitoring for free. We get to be able to use Zonkl on the Python stack. We get to use all the systems that we do for deployments. We just tweak them slightly for whatever it is the acquisition that is being integrated is using at the time.
Yeah, for Python, it's Pyre and Pisa are the two main tools that we work for Python. So one's a typing system, and the other one is a similar static analysis to Zonkl. Again, like, you know, typing becomes a theme for a lot of our product security. So as we've done some of these companies have joined us, whether it's WhatsApp or Instagram, the pattern is generally the same, right? Like, they run their own infrastructure, they run their own code base, they do their own things. We go in, we work with them as part of the acquisition to understand kind of how we can help, how we can like help improve their security as it stays today. And then we introduce them to this really powerful infrastructure that they can get for free if they just transition to that infrastructure. And in every case, they just end up looking at this infra and going like, why am I running my own infra? Like, this is the most powerful infrastructure ever. I'm moving.
And this is something that this is something that keeps coming up in conversations I've been having lately. You know, we had a sponsor interview a few weeks back with Keith Hoodlett over at Thermo Fisher. And, you know, basically when he went in, they didn't really have a formal AppSec program. So what he did, one of the first things he did was to build infrastructure for all of the different development groups. And they're like, yeah, you can run your own build infrastructure if you want, or you can just use this shiny modern one that we built for you that happens to have all of this static analysis built into it. And both of you have mentioned, you know, shades of this already, right? Which is like, oh yeah, static analysis. So essentially, I mean, you've integrated the build and deploy stuff, right? And put your static analysis on that, right? And I imagine that's where you catch the worst of it, yeah?
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, we're probably around 50% of what we find is through these automated means, roughly, like, yeah, ballpark, almost 50%.
I mean, how much code gets committed, like, organization-wide at Facebook in a given day? Because I'd imagine it's quite a lot.
Yeah, it's tens of thousands of diffs a week. So tens of thousands of code changes from thousands of engineers. And so, yeah, like, you know, what I think using this automation to scale is the way that we solve a lot of these problems. And that sort of like draws a line under which we can make sure that we catch a large number of things and then pivot the people that have the expertise onto the stickier, gnarlier problems, the less explored problems, the things that we don't have coverage for. And so like that sort of like yin and yang of like, okay, what can we automate away to then apply the really smart people to some other problem space that is more complicated or requires a human, that's the way that we end up succeeding in the product security space. Like it's just a really important part of really how we tackle security across the board here.
So, I mean, let's talk about those gaps, right? Because already we're talking about, okay, there's the static analysis on tens of thousands of diffs that go into this application every week or these applications every week, right? So you catch a lot of stuff there. But then, I mean, how do you even start to apply like an application security team to do anything dynamic, whether that's, you know, testing, manual testing or automated dynamic testing at scale? That's going to be, I mean, like, how do you even begin? Do you have like 10,000 pen testers? Like, how do you do that? How?
I mean, you know, if you have 10,000 pen testers that we can hire tomorrow that are really great engineers, totally, we've got plenty of open headcount. I will take that in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, like, I think the big thing is using the signals we have to prioritize the work and figure out where we can be the most impactful with the people that are doing reviews. Right. So this is like a full stack of things where kind of on the far end, on the right hand side, we've got our White Hat program, right? Which is one of the biggest in the world. People are submitting bugs all the time. We're triaging them. We're working with them to make sure we get them fixed. Then as you kind of shift a little bit further to the left, we've got our teams of security engineers that are reviewing products, trying to review the code and identify bugs and issues that way, as well as, of course, some contracts that we have with vendors to do that. Then as you shift a little bit further to the left, this is where you have your static and dynamic analysis tooling, fuzzing tools, those kinds of things to try and automate it and empower an individual engineer to solve their own security bugs.
I just got to cut you off there and ask, like, is dynamic testing actually part of the process for everything that gets deployed, or is it more sort of applied by humans ad hoc, like where they think there's going to be an issue?
So it depends on the language and how mature we are. Like, we're always looking to evolve these things. So in some cases we can, like, you know, a lot of the static analysis happens on everything. The dynamic analysis, you know, we may apply it more manually. We've got some places where it's manually, some places where it's a little bit automated, some places where it's self-service. So, again, like, you know, kind of, mixed there. But I think like ultimately we want to get as much coverage as we can there, but the real, like, the, some of the biggest wins then, and the ones that, that we love as well, is as you keep shifting left, is creating frameworks so this stuff never happens.
Yeah.
Right. Like the easiest solution is make sure it doesn't exist. You don't even have to catch it.
That's the advantage of essentially writing your own compiler, right? Like you can do a lot.
But you know, like this is the classic, you know, how do we make sure we build a framework that, to your point, Patrick, you're talking about, when we talked about ways that we get people to use the infrastructure or acquisition, say, oh, we should use this infra. It's a similar thing in like, you know, the product security space, right? Like if we build a framework that makes your life a lot easier. So rather than writing some raw SQL query, it's just like two lines of hack that's like, hey, you know, make this mutation to this thing. Everyone's just going to use that because it's so much easier than like, let me figure out what, okay, I got to make a connection to this database and I got to look it up in this, like, you know, service routing thing. And nobody wants to do that stuff. They don't have to.
No, and you can kill a lot of the dumb stuff at that point, right? Because things like validating user input and stuff, if you just make that automatic, you know, that's nice, right?
Yeah. If you, the further you shift it left, the better. Not everything is going to shift left. You always have to have everything downstream because that will always be a problem and we will always need to invest in that. But again, like if you can convince people like, hey, use this framework. And oh, by the way, this framework makes it so there's no cross-site scripting really possible on the site because, you know, it just auto-generates everything and avoids that. Like that's a huge win for everybody. Yeah. It's easier for the engineer and then it protects us from a bunch of security stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's dumb stuff. I think what's important though is like, those are just simple human mistakes that everybody can make, right? And if we put it out there and make it easy for people to like step on these landmines or make these mistakes, like that's shame on us, right? Like we should make it easy for them to avoid that stuff so they don't even have to think about it, because that's the best way to really empower engineers to make great code and secure systems.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Now, I want to talk about monitoring, you know, sort of at the application level. I mean, I understand that you're going to be doing a lot of monitoring at the sort of infrastructure level, right? You're going to have agents on all of those systems. You're going to be collecting logs. You're going to have a SIEM. You're going to have a SOC, right? Like that makes a lot of sense. But a lot of this has to be built into the application so that when something does go wrong, you know, you've got a hope of picking it up. I do want to talk about something that did go wrong at Facebook. Thankfully, it had a happy ending, but generate a lot of news headlines at the time. And this is when there was this event where someone wrote an exploit essentially for Facebook's application, which would allow them to collect, you know, auth tokens. And they just started harvesting auth tokens at the rate of knots. And I think they wound up with something like, was it like 90 million auth tokens before they got stopped? And then those users were de-authed. And this all happened, I think, you know, in the space of like 12 hours or something. It was a very quick thing. I think it was one of those things where I woke up and read about it happening. Can you walk us through that experience? But walk us through this event from your side, because that would have been a pretty interesting day in the office.
Yeah, it was an interesting day or days.
Chris and I had some interesting days for sure.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of stuff we could talk about here, and I'll walk through it. I was right in the center of a bunch of this stuff. Pedro was right in the center of a bunch of this stuff. But one thing I will do, Patrick, up front is one minor correction. I'm sorry to be a nitpicky jerk, but the actual number of people that were affected by the attack is 29.1 million. The 90 million is like a superset of that, which actually was one of the more interesting things about this whole process.
Yeah, because this is about who used the feature versus who had been exploited by this feature. Yeah, no, I get it. I get it. And that is a perfect nitpick.
So what happened there? So, you know, I think it all started with this sort of like strange anomaly in some data around account activity. And, you know, like you get these anomalies all the time. You know, maybe there's some world event happening that you're not aware of, or maybe there's something going on. And so you sort of say, okay, well, here's an anomaly. And it really wasn't a security anomaly. It was just like this kind of account anomaly. And so the teams are looking at this and looking at it as like, hey, do we have like a bug in our system that's causing like some weird issue? Do we have some data reliability issues? That kind of thing. So as they sort of dug into this and worked to understand it, they started seeing some strange correlations that made them go like, hey, we might have something that's deeper than that here. And so that's when they brought in the security team. And as we dug into it, we started to understand, like, actually, we think this might be an attack on our infrastructure based off some of these correlations. Let's dive in and figure out what's going on. And so from that point, once we kind of determined that there was an actual attack, it was like 3 days, like all into you till you heard about it, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So we identified like, hey, this is something malicious. This is an attack. And we started basically running a number of work streams to go investigate. And so like one of the big ones obviously was remediation, right? We had to figure out what the vulnerability was, how it was being exploited, how we could patch it quickly, and then how we could remediate anybody that may have been affected.
And this is, you know, the thing that I find really interesting about this, right, is you would have actually have had to have like coded a remediation for this. It's not like you could bleep, bleep, bloop, press a few buttons and make it go away, right? Like to fix this would have been difficult, right? Like me through that.
Yeah. So the first, after we understood what the bug was, we kind of looked at what our options were right now. You know, we could rewrite this big chunks of the application and try to do it very quickly. We'd probably like, you know, mess it up. So what we wanted to try and do was figure out, okay, can we create some sort of mitigation? Maybe it affects the features that were involved, and that's not great, but it's probably the right thing to do. And so one of the steps that we took was temporarily turning off this view as feature.
Yeah.
Because that was a key part. And so it kind of disrupted the attack chain, right, by turning off of this feature. And so, you know, that we made some code changes there. We made some changes to sort of limit that and disrupt the actual bug. And of course we figured that out and we're sitting on it, because the other thing we have to figure out is, okay, well now we've got, you know, at the time we had the upper bound was 90 million people that could have been affected by this, kind of going back to when the bug was first introduced in the code base. Like, what do we do about that? How do we log out 90 million people?
How do you figure out which 90 million people to log out? I would have thought would be the interesting question, right? And I think the way you guys came to that is you figured out who had used this feature.
Yep.
And that would make them, that would be an indicator that either they used the feature genuinely or it was someone else using it for them. So just nuke all of them. And then you came to that 30 million figure later.
Yeah, right. So we had data, we could look at the log data and figure out that, okay, 90 million people have used this view as feature. So that's our upper bound, which was an exciting discovery, by the way. Like at some point there were like brief conversations about like, what do we do if we don't know what the upper bound is?
Yeah.
Like, how do you log out?
Like, do we de-auth? Absolutely. What do you got? Like 2.4 billion users,
right?
Like,
people at the time or so. Yeah.
Yeah. So once we, you know, once we figured out the 90 million upper bound, it really became okay, well, the standard thing that you do in incident response, right? Which is, all right, I know how to patch this vulnerability. I know what my upper bound is. How long is it going to take me to figure out a more exact number so I'm more targeted in my remediation? And then in the meantime, like, how much is this going to harm people, and how much worse is this problem going to get? And there's always this kind of balance between those things. But once we figured out kind of the 90 million, we're like, listen, we know what the patch is. We've got a patch ready to go. We can push that patch in like couple of hours max, because our build infrastructure and our deploy infrastructure is so solid and so fast and so dynamic. So I can get this fix out fast. We had figured out, we had to kind of build some special sauce to do that mass scale log out. It was really not the log out, it was invalidating the tokens, but for everybody who was affected, it looked like they've been logged out.
Yeah.
So we can figure out how to invalidate the tokens at scale and then track that to make sure it's complete, because that's something.
But that was the part that I was mentioning before would have actually required some custom software development, right? Like, you know, you would essentially be coming up with a countermeasure. It's sort of like a 90s hacker movie at that point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it was the way it actually worked was, you know, it was in Menlo Park at our headquarters, and there were four engineers. And I said, all right, you guys, you know this problem really well. You know this infrastructure really well. Like, we're going in a room and we're going to disconnect you from everything else. And this is going to be your entire focus. Like, let's stay focused on this. This is one of the critical path items. It's super important to get done. There should be no distractions. And you just get people focused on solving the problem and collaborating together really closely. And they figure it out, right? Like, one of the things that, like, the big things that ended up working well for us was this idea of, we have work streams. Those work streams are well-defined. We have the right people that know the systems working on those work streams, and they stay focused on those work streams. And then we have, like, good communications mechanisms to make sure we're sharing data, but not this sort of like chaotic, everybody talking at once thing. Mm. And so putting some structure around this early on, that was one of the things that, like, in the first weekend, I think Pedro and I spent a bunch of time on a Saturday chatting about, like, we need to put some structure around this thing. We need to make sure that we have good structure for this investigation. Let's make sure we structure our work streams. Let's make sure that we have, like, really strong sort of command structure, for lack of a way to put it, and that we're communicating effectively, but not communicating all the time so everyone gets distracted. And that ended up working out well.
What you're describing is like essentially mass compromise of accounts, but handled front to back, like handled start to finish in about 3 days, which, I mean, that's actually very quick, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, what was interesting for both of us here, so Chris had a lot of experience with incident response for security issues. And so he was leading us towards the, like, these are the things that we have to think about in these cases. I had a lot of experience on incident management in production. That was a big part of my role.
So I actually wanted to ask you, Pedro, because we've just been speaking about, like, one way into Facebook's, like, sensitive data, it's going to be through the application, right? We've just spoken about an incident that was managed where there was a way in through the application. But I also wanted to talk about, like, the ops side, right? The infrastructure side, because that's the other nightmare scenario, right? Is someone being able to come in from the edge, right, and work their way into the core infrastructure. Like, how are you dealing with that risk, right? I'd imagine you're doing all of the standard sort of hardening and stuff on core infrastructure, but I'd imagine there's a huge monitoring component there as well, right? And, like, custom detection tools and SIEMs and SOCs and all of that. Like, can you talk us through that a bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think Chris was starting to talk a little bit about that. You know, one of the things for us to be able to run an infrastructure this big is that we do have a lot of instrumentation, a lot of monitoring that tells us about activities that we have. And so we have the standard things at the edge where we're monitoring for access and we're monitoring for people to try to get in. We have information around, you know, where activity is happening. And if there is anomalies, we have some anomaly detection infrastructure on the back end that does that. We take a lot of our streams of data, and then we put it into a very centralized platform that we built to be able to actually sift the signal from the noise.
So that was going to be my question, which is, like, how tightly do you integrate, like, this information stream that comes out of ops versus information that's coming from the applications, right? Like, does that all go to the same place, or is that different teams?
It all goes to the same place, but then we have people who subscribe to that data. And so in security, we subscribe to a specific set of data from some of those systems. And then we're able to actually process that and come up with some signal.
Yeah. You're doing your own custom ML, because I can't imagine anything off the shelf is going to really be of much help.
There's a lot of custom stack, Patrick. Yep. Like, so Pedro mentioned, we send our data. We have one of the largest, like, data analytics platforms in the world. And if we need to do an investigation on some log data, we just go to this very powerful, gigantic data infrastructure. And that's what we use, because why would I go buy a SIEM when I've got, like, a much more powerful data infrastructure, like, sitting in my environment, right?
Well, the funny thing is, the people, you probably have a bigger team behind the development of your SIEM than some SIEM companies, right?
Yep, we probably do.
And that's the thing about operating at that sort of scale, right? It's a whole different game. And, you know, at this point, I want to ask you, like, you know, what are the lessons that you have learned working at Facebook, both of you, right, that you could then say you went off to work for a typical enterprise, an insurance company, you know, a bank, something like that. What are the lessons you've learned there from operating at that scale that you could then take and apply in a smaller setting? We'll start with you, Pedro. I mean, you're almost a lifer, right? Like, you've been there 10 years. That's like 50 years in normal people years, right? Like, that's a long time. But like, if you were going to go into a normal environment, like what would be the things that you would try to introduce from working in that at that mega scale environment?
I think what happens a lot in both small environments and large environments is that people start building complex systems. And once they are like complex and you start losing your ability to be able to reason around them, a human can only understand so much information. You need to start building a lot of automation and a lot of systems that are going to start making some assumptions for you and some decisions for you. And yet what we forget is that when those systems get complex, we want to try to make them even more complex. And so one of the lessons that I've learned over the years here is effectively always challenging the assumption that we have to do it a certain way and asking a bunch of questions around how can we make it simpler? How can we reason about this problem? Let's think about the cost that we're going to have, and it's either going to be on complexity or systems or people. And people, to be honest, are the most expensive because you have to train them, you have to, you know, manage them, you have to make sure that they have good career development. And so we want to make the systems as simple as possible for people to be able to reason about them and then build a lot of systems that are actually going to make some decisions for you. And so, you know, sometimes...
So keep it simple. You mean flat network, local admin for everyone?
Yeah.
That was a joke. All right. what about you, Chris? What would you take over? Like,
I mean, I hate to go a bit meta level like Pedro did, but I do think the meta level thing that I have learned is that in security in particular, there are different ways to think about these problems, right? So my favorite example is in access control. And this is going to get a little like Facebook and special sauce stuff, machine learning, data science, yada, yada. But one of the big things is we have all these internal tools that we use for various different purposes. They're, of course, custom built. But we need to figure out how we do access control for those tools, which is actually a really hard problem anywhere. Like, access control is a hard problem anywhere. But then doing it at scale for us is also obviously pretty difficult. And so the first thing that we did was we said, okay, well, how are we thinking about this problem? And we actually decided that the way we should think about access control is how do we enable people to get access to the right things, as opposed to how do we lock things down to deny access to the wrong things? And as we started looking at that, one of the things we realized was that we, of course, had authentication logs like anybody does to applications. We collected these authentication logs. We could examine these authentication logs using that data infra and some lightweight data science and figure out like what should the access be? Because, you know, the way that most of these things work at companies is you look at someone's job, you ask them what tools do you need to do your job? You fill out like, I assume, a carbon copy piece of paper and like triplicate that says like, here's your matrix of access, stamp, stamp, stamp. You are approved for this because your job is X. And then when your job role changes, you fill out a new form and triplicate. But ultimately what you're doing is like looking at the patterns of access that people are using and saying, these are the things you need to do your job. And so we could take that, think about it in an enabling way and begin to automate it by examining those patterns and saying like, listen, this is what we think you need to do your job. These are the systems. We've examined the access patterns that you provide. And we've then examined things like where your reporting structure is, what your job title is, your cost center, your team. And by combining those two things, like clustering people together through automation and then, you know, clustering systems and tools together by looking at access patterns and combining those two, we enabled a bunch of access. That's not to say that everyone should go do that. I don't think that's possible for everyone to do. And I don't think like maybe one day. But what it really was about was that mindset from the beginning, which is how can we think about this differently? How can we think about enabling people rather than trying to lock people down? And that unblocked us mentally to be able to come up with this different solution that is really scalable, really powerful, and allows us to do some really great things in access control.
I do want to reiterate what Chris was saying, and I should have said that earlier, which is that when I got here, both from an operational and security perspective, we were your typical shop that both operations and security said no when you came to us with a request. It was difficult. Change was, you know, hard to get through. And so we've changed that mindset and that culture to be much more of an enabler. We want people to do their job. We want them to do efficiently. And so it changes the way that you think about the solutions that you come up with. And I think that there are still a lot of companies out there whose first primary response to somebody wanting to introduce something new, someone wanting to do something different, is, well, that's going to be hard, so we shouldn't do it.
I feel like that is changing though? Like, I feel like we've been wanting that to change for quite a while, but I feel like, particularly over the last couple of years, what it is like, you know, there were people doing the whole DevSecOpsy thing, which just results in a mindset shift anyway, right? Because it brings the security people in contact with other people. They're acting more like a service provider. So that just results in a bit of a mindset shift. That stuff is starting to go much more mainstream now. Like, normal big corporations are starting to do that stuff. I even spoke to a friend yesterday who's likely moving from his role as a pen tester at a very large organization into that more DevSecOpsy sort of role. And yeah, I mean, climb on board, you know, the DevSecOps train is leaving the station and people are getting more stuff done. And a lot of that is, you know, stuff we spoke about earlier about moving stuff further left. And it just makes sense. Now, look, one of the reasons we're doing this thing is like one of the things that we wanted to talk about was, you know, 2020 has been a hell of a year so far. And it spins me out that we're only halfway through it. It feels like we're 50 times the way through it at this point. As people are fond of saying at the moment, March was a hell of a decade. But, you know, from the Facebook perspective, you've got 44,000 staff who all of a sudden had to work from home. I walk us through how you did that, because we've seen a full range of responses from security teams who've been told, okay, you need to enable remote work now, right? You have to do it now. And that's resulted in some really sketchy solutions. It's resulted in some amazingly well stood up stuff pretty much instantly. It's been everything in between. How does a company like Facebook tackle that challenge? Because I'd imagine your workforce is distributed all over the world, all sorts of roles. You know, you've got your corp network. You'd have a lot of people who'd need to access features built deep into the application. So you've got to provision access across a very wide gamut of systems. Talk us through how this happened over this year.
Yeah. So, you know, once we got the announcement that everybody should shelter in place and work from home, and we were going to roll that out globally, that was one of the things that we had to try to figure out and make sure that we were doing well. Turns out that we had started down this path about 6 or 7 years ago, when we really started focusing on the zero trust environments and making sure that we could have people who could authenticate, you know, a managed device from anywhere where they were, and not thinking about our offices as a trusted perimeter, but rather more like a Starbucks, right? Where you
This is the thing. Sorry, I just love that you said that, because my favorite way of describing zero trust, and it's a little bit simplistic, but I love to say treat your LAN like it's the internet. You know, don't trust it. Like, that's just act like everything's on the internet and act accordingly. And from there, like, the whole thing sort of flows, right? But go on. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. And so we had a lot of this already built into the ways that we worked. We had started this migration a long time ago. And so, you know, effectively, I was able to come and work from home, and I had only a small subset of things that I would have to do for VPN to begin with. The biggest challenges that we had actually were supply chain based. How do we get devices to an individual who's working from home? And what do we do?
Best Buy's out of Chromebooks, basically, exactly. Right? That was a problem a lot of people had. I mean, okay, so you know, you're talking about VPNs there. Have you been working since to try to eradicate VPNs? Because I feel like VPNs are going to go the way of the dodo, you know, because they're not very good.
I was talking to Chris the other day about this, which is I was trying to remember how we sort of went down this path early on. And I remember an episode of my own where I was sick at home. I had been there for about 3 or 4 days, and I was really just annoyed at the slowness of the VPN, the fact that I had to connect all the time. I would drop that connection. I had to authenticate separately to it. And I started asking a bunch of questions around why we can't just do authorization the way that we should be doing it normally without a VPN. And so a lot of that set us down the path that we were able to do that. So, you know, we are trying to, for sure. I think that is an aspirational goal. There are certain things that even today, I'm a little bit afraid of not having, you know, sort of like that real connection to it. But we will be able to actually eradicate most of it and make sure that we can connect to our services on the inside our network without actually having a VPN.
I mean, you've got budget. You can pay to have one person at every data center holding a Pony Express, just in case. Right. But I understand why you would feel uncomfortable by not being able to go, you know, VPN SSH go, right? Like that would be that would, you'd feel a little bit naked or something, you know. It's just not a comfortable feeling.
But we are working on getting that comfort, right? We are working on making sure that we have the systems that tell us when things are happening, that gives us the insight if we see some anomalies from any perspective, and you know, whether if there's data that's being exfiltrated, like we know immediately when it's happening and we know exactly where it's happening. And so that kind of stuff is where we're working towards. I do, you know, it's interesting that you said that there is an aspect here of just, I've become used to the comfort of a VPN, and there are certain things that I understand how it works. We do actually still use all our systems for example, for SSH access, like we do two-factor for all those things. Even when you're on VPN, we want to still just make sure that you are who you say you are.
Yeah.
So there is that aspect of making sure that we continue to evolve the ways that we access all our systems, and then eventually try to be able to get rid of VPN for the small percentage of things that we're doing.
And you went certificate-based auth for a lot of this too, didn't you?
We did, right. So there's a certificate on your device, either whether it's a laptop or it's a mobile device, that tells us that we provisioned it, and it communicates with us and sends it over the browser wherever you're authenticating. And
then
sure
you've got like Duo Push on top of that.
Yep, that's exactly right.
I mean, this is the way to do it, right? You know, not everyone can do that. Like, how on earth did you provision all of those certificates, right? Did you build custom tools? Like, what, you know, how? Because it sounds simple, right? Oh yeah, just put certificates on everyone's systems. But it's not. That's PKI, and PKI is hard. How did you do it?
Yeah, there are some purpose-built systems that we built internally. I think that was actually the hardest shift to working from home all the time for 100% of our employees. Is we depended on the physical environment when we handed a laptop to you. We had a help desk employee who was putting on that certificate onto your machine.
Yeah, okay, right.
And so now we have to start thinking about what are the handoff points and how do we do that? It's not like the industry, you know, sort of has decided that remote provisioning is easy for everybody. They make it actually pretty complicated. And so we have to break down each of those components and try to figure out what do we do when we don't have an individual who can verify that is there. And so
it's funny I did a recent interview with Yubico, and they were talking about the same sort of challenge, right? And like they're offering in the pandemic age, you know, some interesting services around actually distributing physical keys to people because, yeah, there's no help desk anymore. And it's a big problem, right? Like it's something that sounds, it's a very simple problem, but it's a big one. So how did you get around that in the end?
So in the beginning, we actually worked on a VDI solution to give people some access before we actually knew how to do that. Today, we're just investing a lot more in MDM and, you know, sort of, I can't remember now off the top of my head what the Microsoft version is of that as well. But we're trying to do a lot of that remote provisioning outside of the VPN.
So all of those Azure outages were your fault? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Oh, would you go? You got a giant checkbook. Just buy all of the VDI, right?
Well, so we did some VDI for a little while so that we could actually get our employees up and running and effective as possible, as quickly as possible. And then we invested in parallel in making sure that we could actually provision those things. And today, we're not 100% done. There's still a little bit of hand-holding that we have from a help desk employee who's working from home, who's talking to a new employee and walking them through, here are the steps that you have to do, you know, open terminal and run this if you have to actually like fix a problem. But we, again, are trying to make that as seamless as possible. And so we built even some custom widgets that we have, for example, on our macOS platform, where there's a menu device that you can click on, and it has a couple of actions that says, you know, fix my device if we can recognize that certain things are not working correctly. So, for example, reprovisioning a certificate is something that we can do remotely now through that menu device. And then the other thing, this is where we actually applied a lot of the production environment mentality. We run Chef locally on those devices as well. And so we have a lot of cookbooks that we've actually written so that we can manage those devices remotely and they can provision them. And we have it for Linux as well. So that's where we sort of apply a lot of our mentality around how to, you know, create the allow list on those applications and how to roll out new software and how to verify that it actually was installed and, you know, get some remote instrumentation that tells us how widely we've deployed it, whether there are errors and those things like that. So.
Well, Pedro, we are nearly 50 minutes into this now, and this feels like a good time to wrap it up. I think you have made regular listeners feel sufficiently jealous at this point. But yeah, it was a real pleasure to chat to you both. Pedro Kanawati and Chris Bream, thank you so much for joining me for this Soapbox edition. I hope we get to do it again. Cheers.
Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, it was fun. Thank you. I appreciate it, Patrick.
That was Pedro Canavati and Chris Bream of Facebook there. Big thanks to them for that. And yeah, I personally really enjoyed that conversation, and I'm hoping they can come back next year and do more of it. That is it from me. A reminder, I am on leave at the moment. I am coming back for the next show on the 29th of July. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.